This is the Mysterious Matters of Max Metters podcast. Number 8, Mysterious Matters of Max Metters is a novel I wrote in 1991. If this is the first time you're listening to this podcast, please go back and start with episode 1, which explains what's going on here. This podcast is a kind of audiobook in which I read the novel to you, in the hopes that you will like it and pick up a copy. Mysterious Matters of Max Metters by Peter Gelman. Chapter 7. I was holding tattered Plutarch's Lives, but not reading it, when Mary rang the buzzer. I had been reading about some general's white dough that he used to convince his troops that he had the favor of the gods, that the doe whispered in his ear sometimes, about how he lost the doe and later found her again. I was thinking about the woods where I grew up, the old rebel woods near D.C. There was a statue of Colonel John Mosby, the great ghost of the Confederacy, the tubercular gorilla. The woods were named after him, and so was my grammar school. We put on plays about Mosby, and the grandson of Robert E. Lee came and gave a speech. He was very old, older even than the grandson of Woodrow Wilson, who lived next door, and I showed him how to throw a frisbee. The woods of the Grey Ghost were mostly torn down now for condos in townhouses, and the metro had a station stop only a few miles away. I could remember even some old farms when I was very young, because the neighborhoods were still being built, and there were dirt roads at first, and I could just remember those old-fashioned sedans with the funny rocket fin taillights. A swarm of locusts came, and their husks clung to the wooden farm fences for years afterward. When I was older, I found one of those husks still clinging to a tree in my backyard. But I was distracted because I was digging a hole for treasure, and I found arrowheads and fossil coral. I remember how I saved up and bought a radio and was not exactly stunned, not exactly amazed, to hear songs like "I Shot the Sheriff," "Superfly," and "Taking Care of Business." Songs like that were like an inoculation of fever, a fever that made you dream in a different language. In the winter, the schools closed for snowstorms, and we played Follow the Leader over the cracking ice, stomping. And one time we rode an ice raft slowly down the length of the creek until the ice broke and we fell in. And another time we searched for the creek's source, which was not Lake Itasca, but a big concrete pipe under Old Lee Highway. The next summer we searched the creek's Crawdad Delta, which was another big pipe, this one iron, under a housing development. But we did find a beaver dam and some rusty iron jaws, old beaver traps. Another time, me and one guy were looking for gold. We were panning for gold in our galoshes, and yes, we actually found a revolver. At first, I thought it was an old toy, but it was too big and heavy. It was rusted out, and just a thin wire of rust remained of the handle where the wood had been screwed. It was the skeleton of an old revolver, maybe a Grey Ghost revolver. We were going to take it home in the bucket, but then I changed my mind, and we argued. But I won, and we put it back, where we found it, several green bends below Chicken Hill, where we sledded and tried to jump our bikes, and Alexander fell and had a compound fracture. The junior high was a public school named after Sidney Lanier, a Confederate soldier who later wrote corn poems about the stricken South, which had nothing to do with the dull, dingy, and humorless students I marched with in P.E. These marching boys of Lanier were learning to listen to Molly Hatchet and Pink Floyd and smoke pot after school. Some of the kids said things like, "The South will rise again," and showed the rebel flag, and said ugly old things like, "Fight, fight, Negro and white." But that was grotesque and alien to my history, and in fact not even slightly interesting compared to Pink Floyd. Rock and Roll, The Great Leveler. The Wall album, more Soviet than Brezhnev, as I thought to myself 11 years later. Lying in Windhouse, listening to an interview with an FMLN guerrilla fighter on KFAI radio, who concluded his confession with, "We're just members of the rock and roll generation." Astonishing words that moved me to tears. It was that interview that made me join the protest at the National Guard airport. It was funny to think how all the world's pieces were mixed up and joined together again. Myself, too. That white doe in Plutarch reminded me of the gray ghost, and I liked those gray ghost woods. What remained of them? What remains now? And the memory was pretty misty. I was wondering about it when Mary came in. Mary came in and we kissed hello casually, but I felt my heart twisting and fluttering like a kite caught on an electrical wire. I noted how I felt a sudden rush of happiness when Mary came in. She put on a John Lee Hooker record, and we looked at it. It was all in German, but it was funny how they quoted Hooker suddenly. "Blues ist Ausdruck eines Lebensflügel." Blues always called it plain old being lonesome. Mary sat next to me on the couch, and I could smell her hair, exuding a clean, perfumey woman's scent. And my body filled with so much longing that I could feel it in my throat, and I thought I could actually taste the la-la-gonging of the word longing. Before I knew what I was doing, I had my arms around her, and I was embarrassed. And just then the music clicked, and I leapt up to put on a new record, 1947, Young Ray Charles. He began to sing, "Baby, how long? How long, baby, how long?" And I sat down again and hugged Mary hard until she said, "Hugged me, hugger, I'll hug you." "No, I wasn't hugging you. I was crushing, 'cause I have a crush on you. Crush me, crusher, will you? I'll crush you." And hugged me hard. "Isn't this cool blues?" I asked. "Makes you feel loose and soft." "Yeah," she said. "Nice jazz piano." "Jazz? Afraid not. This is blues. Listen to the chord progression. Listen to that tight structure. It's blues." Mary shook her head. "It's jazz. It's in the rhythm, believe me. I know. I've danced jazz dance for years. It feels like blues. You can think what you like, but this song is jazz." "But listen to it." "I am," she laughed defiantly. It was the result of ridiculous clowning and goofing up instead of loving. I smiled to disguise my annoyance. "What happened here? You don't like history?" she asked, pointed to the ripped-up Plutarch. Arthur or I had stepped on it when we were pushing, and it had ripped. "Arthur and I had an argument about history, yeah."
"You had another fight?"
"Not really a fight. It wasn't a Gdansk riot or anything."
Almost could have been, though. Luckily, I'm a lamb, and I realized there was nothing to fight about. I don't get it. Why would you want to fight if you don't have some reason to fight? I was feeling like a bug on a pin. This time we had an argument, but it was nothing to fight about. Don't tell me you're fighting over nothing. We just fight because, I don't know, I like him. And for no reason you just smack him? No. No, 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 no. We were just sort of wrestling this time. Sometimes we start pushing on each other and then hitting lightly and then hitting in the face. But not this time, I stopped it. I wanted her to understand that I stopped it, but she didn't seem to hear that. You mean you fight for no reason? That wasn't true. She didn't understand what I had said. That was because I had to lie and not tell her that we were fighting about her. I was mad because it had become a bad thing, a lie, that I wanted not to know her secret unless she told me first. She made me feel mean and stupid, but it wasn't mean between Arthur and me. Maybe it was stupid, though. So I just said, "I guess," and smiled. "What's the matter?" she asked. "I feel like we're arguing, and we don't even know each other, really. Maybe we're just different kinds of people, that's all, honey," she said. And contradicting that, she put her arms around me and pushed me down on the couch. I put both my hands around her waist and noticed that my fingers almost met on her back, and I thought how impossibly tiny she was. I felt the chill of a black premonition. So many secrets sweeping us along. Were we still young? I had to slow and consider. Yes, still. Not just time, not just history, but chemistry, language, and the caprices of ignorance. We were children of the Cold War, already established and traditional, but it was not a war. It was a dull and boring radio nightmare, unimaginable, just words droning, nuclear weapons, technology embargo, diplomatic isolation, treaty violation, condemn action, negotiations suspended, and sometimes a hatred of all governments. And even so, I felt the chill of a vast, unstoppable civilization rolling its knobbed wheels over us. Great, fat Balzacs of wheels carrying blocks to the pyramids. I could tell she was feeling the chill too. And that was important because we shared something deeper down than the surface of words. When we were arguing for no reason, we hugged each other tight to ward off the chill, and then we were kissing and altogether forgetting the black premonition. There was just us. I felt good with my arms around her, but quiet and tense with suspense and unresolved questions, because they might get resolved soon, maybe too soon. She put her arms around me and snuggled close, and I felt very young and excited. We were talking and just telling cowboy jokes. I was there in Prairie Gulch the day the wind stopped blowing and everyone fell down. And, "What hotel you staying at, cowboy?" "What hotel only staying 3 days?" Finally, I realized suddenly, we're talking as easily as true friends do. I didn't consider Tim and Lafcadio true friends in those days, Time soon came I was more humble in my judgments. Because I didn't trust Tim's sincerity, and I didn't trust Lafcadio's intent. Tim was a lout sometimes, and Lafcadio was like a tiger that was watching me, waiting to devour me. Arthur was a true friend, and so was my brother Alexander, mostly. But Arthur was leaving on his little white clipper Balboa to sail to Africa, and Alexander was still working by the DC canals, and we didn't talk often on the phone. I thought, finally, finally I've found someone who I can rely on and trust. At the same time, underneath it, I wondered how I could dare to think so boldly, but I was too intoxicated with the idea that maybe loneliness is not inevitable. I wrapped my arms around Mary's neck and under her knees, and I pulled her into a ball on my chest and hugged her. Here, I thought, here in this 100-pound ball, here is my good, true friend. You ain't as small as even a bumblebee, I told her in my fake old Ginny accent. And I exulted in her hair. Here she is, all in my arms. We laughed, her smallness becoming an old joke already. Good things come in small packages, she said. Oh, yes, I said. As we lay quietly looking up out of the window at the cloudless blue, I thought about it, and her lips, close to my ear, brought me back from my reverie because she was saying, I love you. It startled and surprised me, and she quickly said, it's okay if you don't love me back. I was going to respond, but it would have been a lie, because I didn't know yet if it was true. How could I know? I just couldn't lie about it, so I said nothing. But I was very happy she said it, and worried that I didn't say it back. So I fumbled for the words to try to tell her. I said, I can't say it yet, because I guess, I don't know. I can't make a promise yet. Oh, she corrected me. I wasn't making a promise. I've given you no promises. I was starting to feel bad that she said it like that, so I said, I'm not asking for any. But methinks I was disingenuous. She kissed each finger of my hand, then took my arm and put it around her back, and we embraced each other tightly, and then lay back kissing more and more ardently. She felt soft in my arms, like a little animal, like a bird, but also like a spider. To hell with Arthur McGregor, I thought. Even if he's right about her secret, this proves it doesn't matter. She loves me. I unbuttoned her shirt. After a while, I took off my own shirt. Her body felt so warm on mine, her hands so small on my shoulders. When I started unbuttoning her blue jeans, I felt her legs become hard, and I stopped. What's wrong? I asked. She seemed embarrassed. Okay, but don't rape me, she said. I was shocked and mad and moved away from her to the edge of the couch. What do you take me for? A rapist? I yelled. My mind was spinning. I felt myself getting more and more furious. I was getting mad out of proportion, and I was afraid I'd hit her. So I jumped up and looked at her and away. I'm sorry, she said, changing back to how she was before.
soft, and eager. I could not stop being angry. You don't trust me. What made you say such a thing to me? I choked and sat down. I hardly know you, she said. And you think I'd do anything if you didn't want it? I'm sorry, she said, pulling me closer, but I resisted. I'm a little defensive. I had a bad experience with a guy I went out with for a while. That's terrible, I made myself say. I was feeling the lazy backwash of my unrelieved anger, and I was confused and out of breath. I jumped up and paced up and down. Then I saw how she sat on the couch holding her shirt over her in the shade of the dying afternoon and looking at me very sad, and I felt better, only sad too. Let's get out of here, I said. I went over to her and took her hand and said, let's go for a walk. No, no, she said, gripping my hand tight. Somehow like an animal, more instinctive than thoughtful. Let's stay here. I'm sorry. Pretend I didn't say anything. I want to. I was confused, but didn't say anything as she slipped off her clothes. While we were doing it, all my confusion burst into fire and water, and I was crying, and she was too. Are you in the dump yards, honey? No, this is nice. You're nice. No, I'm nasty, but you are nice. I'm nasty too. Look at me. Yes, you are a nasty boy, but that's why you are so nice. Is your name really America? My name is America, but call me Mary, please. Wow. I'm making love to America. Wow. Wow. Your name is America, really? That's so cool. Yeah, I had some funny parents. The funniness of the father passeth oneth to the third generation. Is this funny? No, this is history. This is the lamb. This is me, and this is you. This is the white doe. Here comes the white doe. She speaks the words of a god, but it's a joke. I don't understand, but I got to laugh. You should have a funny name too. You're a pretty weird guy. Yeah? Yeah. Yeah? Yeah. Yeah? Oh, yeah.
Thank you for listening. Mysterious Matters of Max Matters by Peter Gellman is available as a traditional paper book through popular online booksellers. It is also available as an ebook for Kindle and Nook and other formats. The Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 3.0 Unported License protects this work.